Hello, and welcome to Leading Into Tomorrow, the podcast series from EY, where we explore how public sector organisations can innovate to respond to challenges and opportunities. I'm your host, Ollie Jones, EY Parthenon's global leader for the government and public sector. Each episode, we'll be joined by expert guests for unique insight into how they've created strategies and how they are leading transformation to deliver those strategies. Our focus this time is on how public sector leaders can adapt to respond to the most testing of challenges. Joining us are Ian Thomas, CBE, Chief Executive of the Royal Borough of Kingston-upon-Thames. Kingston is a large local authority in southwest London and a place very close to my heart. I was born and bred here and indeed now live only a few minutes away from Ian's offices. Ian has more than 30 years' experience in local government with many career highlights that we will explore today. Hello, Ian.
Hi, Ollie. It's a pleasure and also great that you're so close to me here in Kingston.
Great, thank you. And I'm also joined by Helen Sunderland, a partner at EY who specialises in local public services. Helen's worked for many years assisting local governments throughout the UK in their transformation journeys. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Ollie.
And thanks for joining us. Ian, let's start at the top, and if you could just tell us a little bit more about your role at Kingston at the moment.
So I'm the Chief Executive of the Royal Borough of Kingston-upon-Thames. As you said, Ollie, southwest of London, one of London's 32 boroughs, and then you have the City of London in addition to that, serving circa 180,000 people. But a place that's vibrant, one of the main shopping destinations in the capital, and is rich and vibrant with culture, great open spaces, lots of things to do. Clearly, Ollie, I'm doing a sell on my place. I've just started the podcast, but you know, a really great council and a great organisation and a great place to be, as no doubt you can testify as someone who lives in close proximity to the Guild Hall here.
I can definitely do that. It's been nearly 50 years. So we are going to come back to Kingston in a minute, but I'd actually like to start further up north in the UK, in Rotherham. And Ian, you were awarded a CBE for the role you played in transforming Rotherham's children's services after a period of crisis. For those listeners who won't know what that crisis was and what you inherited, can you start by telling us a bit more about the situation you faced when you first joined Rotherham?
Well, it's going back some years now, Ollie, but I understand why people are interested in the story. This is a story of a tragic set of circumstances where, over a 16-year period, Professor Alexis Jay found that circa 1,400 girls had been abused over that period of time, between 1997 and 2013, through child sexual exploitation. And it's something that really rocked the town, that this had been going on for so long, and that perpetrators of the abuse had not been held to account over that time. There had been a failure across agencies to take assertive action. And when I landed in Rotherham, I'd had a successful period working with colleagues in Derbyshire before that. And I found a workforce who were, I would say, they were on their knees. They were being internationally vilified, and they were tired. They were under siege. We had the media camped outside of the council offices every day. We had the English Defence League marching through the town every weekend. We had our councillors being followed and, I would say, you know, targeted for responses to some really difficult questions about what hadn't been done. And my role as the statutory officer, the then director of children's services, was to work with people to improve the response to child protection and supporting children in need of public care. I was also charged with putting services in place for the survivors of the abuse, and also working with the police to bring sexual perpetrators to justice. And I have to say, Ollie, the situation was complicated, I would say, by the racial dynamic, because what Professor Jay found was that the majority of victims were white, and the majority of perpetrators, by and large, were of Pakistani origin. But this street-based abuse was something that, as a country, we were gradually getting our heads around, and what many people today call contextual safeguarding, issues where children and young people are at risk outside of the family home. So this was something we were getting our heads around. Professor Alexis Jay, to her credit, called it out for what it was, and there was a real call for action, as one can imagine, to resolving these very complex, tragic issues.
Ian, thank you for that description. And you describe an enormous set of challenges that you and many others in that community, you know, successfully addressed over many years of hard work. And can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, what you did? You talked about the workforce you inherited, and, you know, you used the words, they were sort of almost on their knees, very evocative. Tell us a little bit about, you know, what you did as a leader and a manager to put that service sort of back on its feet.
Well, it certainly wasn't something that I did alone. Whilst I was the statutory officer responsible, I had lots of help from the commissioners who were in situ, the elected members that were in place there, a strong corporate team, as children's services are never effective in a vacuum, our partners, our peers, and of course, the amazing staff, many of whom are still there today doing excellent work. In fact, when we'd achieved the turnaround 3 years later, 75% of the staff were there from the very beginning and had kind of seen it through. So that's testament to the quality of the people that were there when I arrived. The vision was smart. It was a mission to ensure children's lived experiences was an outstanding one by 2018. And we were obsessive about protection, about school readiness and readiness for the world of work. We used an approach called appreciative inquiry. In my view, people generally do not come to work to do a bad job. There were hardworking people, committed people, who were proud of their place in spite of the CSE scandal that had rocked the town. So as a system, it was important to recognise these strengths, to develop a more positive mindset from which to enhance our collective response. I'd also say that we had to create the conditions to ensure compliance with statutory requirements, initially manageable caseloads, establishing a highly skilled, capable, permanent workforce, a comprehensive early help offer working across the partnership, and utilising the great skill base within the professional network to develop positive relationships with families over time. Promoting Nelson Mandela's theory that it takes a village to raise a child. We also invested in a new IT case management system, promoting what I'd call psychological safety, a culture of learning as opposed to blame, and ensuring access to regular reflective supervision. And then we went on to another phase, because you start off focusing on compliance, but then you need to think about quality. And in the second phase, leading up to the re-inspection, our unrelenting focus was on practice quality, introducing a blend of practice models, restorative practice, social pedagogy, and signs of safety. And we worked hard on developing a winning mindset, a sense that we could be as good as any other brilliant children's services in the country. I make reference to sports psychology here and the work of Whitmore and Covey, as we adopted a coaching and mentoring principle-led initiatives to accelerate our progress. And working with the team, using Cotter's 8-step change model and Seddon's systems leadership, what we saw was an improvement in quality over time that resulted in the regulator finding that we had improved from being the bottom 6% in the country to within the top 16% in the country within 3 years.
Ian, thank you. A fascinating insight there into how you reacted to the most challenging and harrowing of situations. We'll touch on some of those themes again, but first, I'd like to bring in Helen, if I may, and talk about reactions to the COVID pandemic. Helen, I wanted to ask you whether you have any examples of local authorities that have demonstrated an innovative approach in their response to COVID, or indeed to any other challenges that face local governments today.
Thanks, Ollie. And I think, you know, it's been fantastic to kind of hear Ian talk and hear the themes of agility, of resilience and of trust in your staff, in your communities, in residents to kind of all rise to the challenge. And I think three really important themes of Leading Into Tomorrow for me that kind of come to bear. I mean, in terms of examples, one of the things that I think is really come to the forefront in the last 2 years is the importance of kind of data, really, and actually how being able to make informed decisions on reasonably robust and kind of fairly readily available data sources has been really critical. And almost how we also see in a crisis, it's very easy to break down some of the barriers that are there in normal times as well, you know, kind of integration of NHS shielding data into broader local authority kind of data platforms has been, I think, a really innovative example by some of the London boroughs around and other organisations as well around that, to actually start to really look at a proactive approach to outreach. Because one of the things I think, we've seen it with the downturn in referrals to children's services and some of the other tragic events, like where you start to remove contact and remove visibility and people are locked in their own homes, it becomes really, really difficult to kind of understand and assess risk. And actually seeing local authorities really do an about turn on that proactive approach, that proactive outreach for any areas of concern where people were shielding, or any even just welfare calls. So it doesn't have to be a massive influx of expensive services, actually just a phone call to check in how people are doing when we know they live alone, when we know that they're isolated from family and carers who normally would be spending time with them. And then actually the again, linked to Ian's point, the real kind of convening power of local government with its partners to bring together community responses to that kind of problem statement I've just described. So the kind of architecture of multiple voluntary and community organisations that are out there, you know, delivering support and services to people who are otherwise unable to either access statutory services or kind of get out and do things themselves because of various circumstances. And I suppose I'd come back to that point on trust, actually. I think, and Ian, perhaps you've got some reflections. Like one of the themes that's come out, you know, over the past 10, 15 years is this kind of concept of system leadership. And actually, there are things that within your own gift and your own control that you can deliver on. But actually, and I think you told the story really beautifully in Rotherham, that there are so many parts of this that are not within your own gift to deliver on. And therefore, the skills in the leadership of a system in its broadest sense, both public sector partners, business partners, voluntary and community sector partners, is really critical. And such an underpinning point of that is the ability to all trust each other. And I don't mean that in the kind of cynical sense. I mean that we're all kind of there together, you know, taking steps forward together, and we kind of all trust each other to play our part within that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You've both talked about, you know, team, the importance of teams. And a question for both of you, maybe I'll start with Ian, is, you know, what are the actions that people within the system and leaders within the system can take to kind of promote that trust and activate that level of trust and that level of teamwork?
Yeah, I absolutely endorse what Helen said about trust. It's a word that I used in a recent meeting with partners and the most senior health partner in the room. And I said to the virtual room, you know, I actually trust this woman. And it was like a tumbleweed moment, you know, jaws dropped. And I think it was really important to say that. We are starting to emerge from this pandemic. And as we do so, we face a number of wicked issues. This classic textbook VUCA conditions are upon us. Volatile, uncertain, complex and ambiguous, which will require us all to become adaptive leaders. A concept created by Harvard's Ronald Heifetz, So when contemplating how we should lead our response to the aforementioned challenges, there are numerous national policy drivers that could provide many of the answers, getting to the point here, Ollie, in terms of the response. And these include the Levelling Up White Paper, Health and Care Bill, the Social Care, Social Housing White Paper, Adult Social Care White Paper, the Care Review, and Review of Special Educational Needs. But the key thing for me is that it's really important, given these levers, that we work hard, cross-departmentally, and in an anti-silo way to ensure that we achieve optimum impact using these policy drivers and enablers such as tech. So just going back to the point around trust, we are not going to be able to effectively address these wicked issues unless we really pull together in the same direction as Helen has alluded to.
Thanks, Ian. Really interesting, and I love the way that trust is a solution to the challenges, as you said, of VUCA, volatility and uncertainty and so on. That's really interesting positioning. Helen, do you want to come in on this and give some further perspectives on this need for trust?
Yeah, and I think there's a couple of things for me. One is, and Ian, it was really interesting as you were just listing the variety of policy levers. And, you know, had we hours, the full list, I think, would go on for months. And I think there's something about how do you pick your way through those to agree some joint place-based priorities? Because I think there's so many differing priorities that it's kind of set departmentally, that actually that real step forward in place leadership, so just slightly different, similar to, but slightly different from system leadership, to understand, you know, for the residents in communities in Kingston, in Barking, in Cumbria, wherever, kind of what is our goal, collective goal across health, care, work and pension, you know, around inclusive growth. And then I think probably some of the really exciting steps forward we're seeing in local levelling up plans, such as kind of Birmingham's and Essex's, that start to knit together some of those policy levers with a real focus on inclusive growth. And I think that for me is a really exciting, you know, in the kind of policy and priorities context of building trust, that places, Kingston being one of them, are kind of coming together to say, this is what we want to collectively achieve as a system for our residents and communities. So I think that's kind of number one. And there's some, you know, some notable examples that we're seeing across the country in that space that kind of transcend political boundaries as well, which I think is really quite exciting. I think there's something on how you create and innovate on capacity that sits underneath some of those priorities, and actually how as leaders we unpick some of the practicalities on that side of things to just unblock some of the skills and capabilities that we want to access. So our neurodiverse centre of excellence that we've created in Manchester is a route to tapping into a kind of talent market that was previously a little bit tricky to tap into, because additional support is potentially needed through the recruitment and retention process, that we've got a whole brilliant, fantastic load of people and resources that we can now tap into that previously hadn't been there.
Helen, thank you. Designing and executing these types of strategies requires great leadership. Next, let's look at the importance of leadership within frontline public services. So, Ian and Helen, we've talked a lot about some challenges, but we've also talked a lot about how teams and teams of leaders can address those challenges. And I'd just like to dive deeply into a couple of concepts that you've both mentioned. Let me start with psychological safety. Ian, if I can start with you, can you just tell me a little bit more about how you approach psychological safety and the things that you do with and communicate to your teams to promote that sense of safety?
Yeah, it's a term that's becoming more and more widespread, isn't it? Psychological safety. And what we mean by it is promoting a no-blame culture. There's a brilliant picture, isn't there, of Jurgen Klopp is holding one of his young players. You know, it's a bit of a bear hug, and it's a kind of "I've got your back, kid" bear hug. And apparently he'd said to the young player that whatever happens, it's on me. You know, go out there and enjoy your football, and whatever happens, it's on me. And that gave that player the freedom to express himself on the field without fear of being blamed. Going all the way back to the Rotherham story, how we run our business today in Kingston, it is all about trusting people to do good work and being creative and innovative without fear of failure, because failure is a reality. Learning from mistakes is a necessity, right? So if you can create a culture where you learn from mistakes, you encourage innovation, and for people to express themselves, you know, this is about exploring the art of the possible here. I think that goes a long way towards promoting what we're calling psychological safety. And I think it's important that as leaders, we role model it in that classic coaching methodology around supporting people to be the best that they can be, and them taking responsibility to achieve self-efficacy. So I take the team approach seriously here. And two things spring to mind. One, I think we do better when we play to the strengths of people within our teams. And two, I don't have a problem with not being the smartest in the room. And in Kingston, I'm very fortunate to be enveloped in a pool of talent where everyone is encouraged to be the best that they can be.
And Helen, you might come in on there. Ian mentioned that you hear a lot about psychological safety across many different organisations these days, and I wanted to give you a chance to come in.
Thank you. And you almost stole my line, Ian, although you framed it a slightly different way. One of my favourite sayings, and one I truly believe, is if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. And I think that's great to your point number two that you raised, because I kind of genuinely believe if you want to take a development, well, a couple of things. If you want to take a developmental approach to life and a growth mindset, surrounding yourself with people who agree with you all the time is not the right way to grow as an individual. And I think having that level of authenticity in your own leadership style is then the thing that creates psychological safety in others, because you're essentially role modeling your own vulnerability, your own willingness to develop, and your own recognition that sometimes, and I say so, I won't say often because it's not a great advert for EY, but sometimes you're wrong. Not always. So I think there's something in that around how you actually role model that kind of vulnerability and that authenticity, that when others then see you, you know, living and breathing the creation of psychological safety, that's really important. I think the second bit, and we've touched on it a little bit, is how you create that sense of belonging in a team. You know, I sort of joked a little bit about rebuilding a bit of fun into life, and where that, how that builds trust. It's really important that is done in an inclusive way, and that we don't kind of revert back to the old boys club of everybody going to the pub at 5 o'clock, and actually how we create that sense of fun in an inclusive way to make sure everybody can connect in and grow, and it's not to any detriment, is also really, really important. Like, I think everybody being on teams has been a great leveler, actually, in some ways. And I think there are some bits of that we need to preserve in the way that we kind of bring people in and create teams with that. It's sort of forced a conscious making of connections with people, because you're not just passing people in the corridor. I find asking people's opinion, like I you know, not starting with I think this, but actually what do you think, and I think in and to Jurgen Klopp as well, you know, this is on me, don't worry, like I'm seeking advice and I'm engaging with you, but actually ultimately I've got your back in this, because we make this decision together, and we kind of stand together and I stand behind it. And I think they're just some reflections on that.
Fascinating. And I'm personally also so pleased we managed to get Jurgen Klopp into one of these podcasts. That's great. Helen and Ian, that's fascinating series of leadership questions and analysis and thoughts coming out of this. Just to finally wrap up, Ian, can I put you on the spot and say, if you had one single piece of advice for a leader in a similar position to you, what would that advice be?
some question to end there, Ollie. There is so much to say. It's been a great conversation where we have discussed the complexity of the challenges facing us before any reflection over the last half an hour or so, really, on what the invasion of Ukraine means for the world and ultimately our global communities. So in answer to your question, I would say that given the changing world around us, the status quo presents as an existential threat to the development of social capital and an equitable quality of life for all within our society.
Thank you. Fabulous last answer. We must stop now. So, Helen, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Ollie.
And Ian, thank you so much for giving us your time. We really do appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It's a pleasure and privilege. Thank you.
Do join us next time when we'll hear from more expert guests about how they are leading transformation. Also, you can subscribe to this series so you won't miss an episode. From me, Ollie Jones, Ian Thomas, and Helen Sunderland, thanks for listening and goodbye.